Jason said. I didn't want him mixing with his old crowd, so I sent him to stay with his family. They seemed quite happy to see him.
It can be that way with the lower-end adventurers, Thalia said. A family can work for years, generations even, just to get an adventurer in the family. Adventuring is a dangerous life, though, and not everyone has the training, temperament, or talent. Add on the family pressure, and it's hardly a surprise when many fall short. Some end up in the household guard of families like mine. Others end up working for criminals in the old city.
Or a bit of both when they end up in your son's employ. Thalia frowned.
It seems we have been a little too loose with the reins when it comes to my son. His father wants to give him the room to come into himself, while I prefer a more guided approach. We raised Cassandra my way and Thadwick his. Marriage is a matter of compromise, after all. This recording of yours lays my boy's follies out on a slab.
I have another recording, Jason said. Has word got around about the dead adventurers in Old City yet?
From this morning? Not widely, but yes.
That was you? Your son sent his lackeys to keep me from revealing everything. I have it all recorded. They don't mention Thadwick at all, which I imagine was a point quite specifically made to them. If someone were to go round up the survivors, though, I doubt getting them to talk would be tricky, especially with my corroborating witness from the recording you just saw.
Is he safe, this witness?
Safe enough, so long as your son is prevented from taking revenge. Thalia sighed.
That boy, she muttered. I think his father and I need to have a very long talk. What are your intentions?
For your son? Nothing. Regardless of what he's done, I know you'll protect him from anything within my power to do. I could kill him, but I know I'd quickly follow him to the grave.
Then you're willing to forgive?
That's asking a bit much. I'm willing to be patient. My desire to stay in your daughter's good graces is a better shield than he could hope for. The most I can hurt him is to collect more than enough evidence to give your family a headache for which he is directly responsible. In addition to the recording you saw, I have copies of all the relevant documents and another recording of finding them all, in case something mysteriously happens to the originals.
What inspired you to look into the Hall of Civic Records?
Where I come from, we don't investigate with magic, Jason said. When it comes to business fraud, you follow a paper trail. Once I heard about a monster known for death and destruction that keeps turning up without either, plus the highly regulated and valuable nature of the lumber territories, it seemed obvious what was going on. All I had to do was figure out who stood to profit, then prove their involvement.
You must have needed help to find all that. I'm surprised that records official didn't come to us. It's widely known that we'll double any bribe.
I didn't offer a bribe, Jason said. I told her a story.
It must have been some story. You're thorough, I'll give you that. The question is, what will you do with all this information? Frankly, I'm surprised to find you here. I've had you looked into quite thoroughly, and everything I've heard suggests you would start shouting this information from the rooftops. You seem to have a dislike for aristocratic power structures.
I'm just some iron ranker, Jason said. If I lay out an exploitative land grab by your family, then all that does is demonstrate your power when you face no real repercussions. All you would suffer is the reputation hit of bumbling the affair to the point it went public. A headache, but one easily endured.
You may be underestimating the damage to our reputation, Thalia said. Greenstone is a productive city with decent work for those who want it. If our reputation suffers too much, then we have to start paying more or people will move into the service of other families. We may have power, but there's always a balance.
Yes, but the scales are rigged, Jason said. Be that as it may, this won't start some populist revolution. I need to go up a few ranks before I can start changing the world. In the meantime, all I can do is go for the best outcome I can see.
Oh?
If I make a big fuss, then your family pushes back. I'll suffer, the lumber mill owner, Lindover, will suffer. Poor Dean, who I promised to shield from all this, will definitely suffer. And when everything is said and done, you'd probably end up with the land anyway.
You're not exactly painting my family in a positive light.
You have power, Jason said. That's the nature of power. So for now, the best way to go is to see this quietly brushed under the rug.
And what do you want in return?
Here's how I see it going, Jason said. I make a discreet report to the Adventure Society to close out the contract. Straight to the office of the director to help keep a lid on the details. Your family compensates Lindover for the months of stalled production, and all the preparations Clemenston made in preparation for a takeover get rolled back. Dean doesn't suffer any blowback for having come clean, and Jerick is quietly struck off the Adventure Society roll.
You don't want him punished for trying to kill you?
If he were put on trial for trying to kill me, the reason why would be an inevitable question. Also, I'm not the kind of person that kills the minion when he can't kill the master. Losing his society membership is enough.
What about the men you killed this morning?
The ones I killed already had their chance, Jason said, with flint in his voice. I let most of them go.
Most of them? You killed 5. How many people did you fight?
Elspeth Arella will have the recording. I imagine she'll show you when she's leveraging your family. Thalia gave a wry smile.
I dare say you're right. So you're willing to leave Thadwick to my family?
We both know he's out of my reach, Jason said. But regardless of how powerful your family is and my affection for your daughter, there's only so far I'm willing to be pushed. I'm running out of mercy for your son.
You know, my husband won't be happy about this outcome. He's been wanting to see some initiative from Thadwick.
Then he should wait to see some morals, Jason said, his expression turning hard.
He won't like compensating the mill owner either.
He doesn't have to like it, Jason said. He just has to do it.
I thought the whole point of you taking this approach was to avoid provoking us.
And you need to recognize that I'm not a doormat you can just walk over. I have my bottom line, Lady Mercer. You would do well not to cross it.
Is that a threat? She asked, raising an eyebrow.
Yes. She smiled.
Mr. Asano, you have some backing, but you are ultimately an iron ranker lost in a world he does not know.
Thalia's silver rank aura pressed down on Jason.
You pose no threat whatsoever to me or my family, she told him.
I imagine a thought very much like that was the last to pass through Cressida Vane's head before it was smashed open. Thalia laughed, breaking the tension.
You really don't flinch, do you? My daughter certainly knows how to pick them. All right, Jason. Lindover will be duly compensated and Thadwick will be suitably chastised. I'll see to it my husband doesn't kick up too much of a fuss. He dotes on Cassie and her approval of you will go a long way.
In my world, fathers often don't care for their daughters' gentlemen friends.
The gods know my husband has his failings, Thalia said, but a failure to trust his daughter's judgment isn't one of them.
They stood up. Very well, Jason said. I imagine you'll be pushing all this onto Clemenson, making out he was behind everything as a way to ingratiate himself with his aristocratic backers.
Are you all right with that?
The man was clearly complicit, and fetched one of your son's lackeys to kill me, so yes. Don't be too harsh on him, though. Not many can say no when the Mercers tell them what to do.
You make us sound like tyrants, Thalia said.
That's the thing, Jason said. You are if you want to be. Jason was sitting on a bench in the Park District, speaking into a recording crystal floating in front of him. It was sort of a business fraud kind of deal. There was a lot of waiting around, but it gave me a chance to catch up on my reading. I was stuck at this abandoned lumber mill for 3 days with a guy named Kyle. Nice enough bloke, but really only likes to talk about wood. I suspect he's very good at his job, but not much of a conversationalist. My friends Farrah and Clive, I'm sure you've seen them on some of these recordings, they've been foisting a lot of magical theory texts on me, so I was able to get stuck into those. It's pretty fascinating, but I can't tell them that. They're rabid enough as it is.
Hello, handsome.
A sultry voice came from behind. Jason grinned as Cassandra sidled onto the bench, leaning into him.
Is this one of the recordings you're making for your family back home? She asked, looking at the crystal.
It is, Jason said.
Family, this is Cassandra. We've been seeing each other socially.
Is that how you describe it?
Cassandra asked cheekily. That's how I describe it to my mum, Jason said, taking down the recording crystal.
Well, you impressed my mother, Cassandra said.
Dad, not so much. And I'd watch my back around Thadwick.
One of his henchmen tried to kill me, so yeah, I'll be watching out. What about you?
Mother said you barely mentioned me, she said with a pout.
I can't go around making decisions based on dark, gorgeous eyes, he said. Besides, integrity is sexy. He reached out for her hand as they sat side by side, intertwining their fingers.
You'll be away for a little while, he said.
I don't like that you're not coming, she said. We could have had a fun little trip away.
We can do that when you come back, Jason said. I assume your family owns an obnoxiously large boat. We can have a little sailing trip. A picnic basket, some wine, a small army of nautically adept servants.
She laughed, resting a head on his shoulder.
Something to look forward to.
You can tell me about your exciting adventures in the astral space.
Deal, she said. Maybe you should round out your awakening stones while we're gone, she said. Take the chance to blitz some one-star contracts. Get moving towards bronze. You have to get there before I hit silver, you know.
My friends told me not to do that, Jason said. It seems there might be an unusual opportunity not long after they get back.
Oh? She prompted.
They're still not giving me any details, Jason said. It's something to do with why they came here in the first place. They're expecting another adventurer to arrive. A gold ranker, apparently.
I've heard rumblings about that. Maybe you should catch that thief giving everyone so much trouble. My uncle and the Adventure Society director have been quite contentious about it, behind the scenes.
The whole thing seems sketchy to me, Jason said. High-profile jobs, the Duke and Elspeth Arella taking such an interest. The whole thing smells of politics.
You know, she was almost caught a few days ago. A group of adventurers almost pinned her down, but they were attacked.
By who?
No one knows, Cassandra said. They just slowed them down for long enough for her to escape, then fled themselves. Dressed all in black. They weren't even Iron Rankers.
I told you, Jason said. Politics. There's a mess of undercurrents running through the whole business.
You don't want to catch her?
She's robbing from rich people, Jason said. I can appreciate that.
Aren't you rich?
Not compared to you.
Chapter 98. The Point of Money and Power. The Adventure Society campus was a sea of chaos as the grand expedition prepared to depart. With the Ustai detained in the marshalling yard and being prepared to move, the adventurers were gathering in front of the main administration building. Neither space was designed for that many people or that kind of activity, so people were spilling out all over the campus. Jason navigated the commotion-filled campus, leisurely eating an apple. He watched absently as an Ustai made a run for it, with a couple of Adventure Society officials in pursuit. He reached the administration building, where a crowd of people swarmed around the carriages that would take them out to the desert relay stations. The humongous Ustai sand barge was going to be used, along with smaller sand barges supplied by the Magic Society. It had been a good choice to make his farewells to Gary, Farah, and Rufus at the inn, rather than at the assembly point. Looking at the huge mess and hearing the harried shouts, Jason was somewhat happy that he wasn't a part of it. He was disappointed he wouldn't get to see the inside of the astral space, though. One of these days, he consoled himself. He approached the space in front of the admin building, where the adventurers were gathering. He paused as he felt the wild storm of auras crashing together in a maelstrom. Not everyone had the control that came from just having an aura power, let alone the kind of training Jason had received from Farah. He used that training to suppress other auras in a very small space around his body, allowing him to move closer without being overwhelmed.
He noticed a lot of Iron Rankers looking woozy because they couldn't do the same. Farah's emphasis on the importance of aura training was once again borne out. It took him a while to track down anyone he knew in the crowd, as they were all restraining their auras to avoid adding to the mess. He found Danielle Geller busily directing the loading of supplies, pausing only long enough to point Jason in the direction of the main mass of Gellers. If he had come at the crowd from the other side, he quickly realized, he would have had no trouble. The Gellers were gathered en masse, looking like a modeling agency that had formed an Olympic team. Surprising Jason not at all, they were already packed up and ready to head out. He nodded to those he knew as he made his way over to where Rick and Phoebe were talking, while Humphrey was saying goodbye to Gabrielle. Rick's team was also there, Jonah laughing at Humphrey.
"You're going away for a few weeks," Jonah jeered. "It's not like you're going off to war."
"Leave them be," Jason said as he approached. "They're sweet and earnest. The world could use more of that."
"I'm glad you think so," Cassandra said, suddenly standing next to him. He smiled as she slipped her hand into his.
"Oh, hey," he greeted, voice softening with pleasure. "Can you teleport?"
"Maybe," she said. "A girl has to have some secrets."
"I have secrets too," he said.
"My fried chicken spice mix is better than my essence abilities."
She laughed and nodded in the direction of her own family.
"Are you going to come see me off?"
"Of course," he said, and waved at Humphrey with a hand Cassandra hadn't claimed.
"See you in a few weeks, Hump."
"Go die in a bog,"
Humphrey called back. He winced at the startled look this earned from Gabrielle, which caused him to glare at Jason's laughing face all the more. Cassandra led Jason through the chaos to where her own family were preparing. No one could match the numbers of the Geller family, who drew from branches all around the world, but the Mercers still made an impressive showing.
"What do you think you're doing, Asano?" came Fadwick's voice.
Jason sighed.
"You need to get away from my sister,"
Fadwick said, marching up to Jason.
"You need to stop sticking your nose into business that isn't yours. You had to go and ruin my deal, didn't you?"
Fadwick, Jason was about to point out that with all the ways his family had to legally exploit people, Fadwick still managed to find one that was against the law, but stopped himself. Instead, he took a slow, cleansing breath.
"You know what, Fadwick? You have a good trip." "What does that mean?"
Fadwick asked suspiciously.
"Just wishing you well," Jason said. "I'm going to try and put more positivity into the world."
"You're weird," Fadwick said, giving Jason a wary look. His mother walked over to them, placing a hand on Thadwick's shoulder.
"Do go finish stowing your gear on the carriage, dear."
"Why didn't we bring servants for that?" Thadwick complained.
"There aren't enough servants where we're going, dear. And you may have noticed that things are crowded enough."
Danielle Geller's voice boomed over the crowd through some form of magic amplification.
"All non-expedition members, please clear the area as we are getting ready to depart."
Jason leaned in to gently kiss Cassandra, only for her to forcefully latch onto him. After a lingering kiss, they stood leaning into one another, foreheads together.
"You're being naughty," he said, softly. "A naughty genius. You've certainly got me figured out. Somehow, I doubt that."
Soon Jason stood off with other well wishes as a huge train of carriages rolled away. In the empty space left behind, Jason was about to leave when he was approached by Vincent.
"You're not on the expedition?"
Jason asked. His brain started turning over, and he laughed.
"I get it. Everyone wanted in on this expedition, so Arella let all the people who aren't wildly on board with her agenda go. That gets her some bureaucratic capital, and while they and most of the city's big power brokers are gone, she can institute a few sweeping changes."
"You got that just from my still being here?"
Vincent asked.
"Just postulation, but it's what I'd do."
"Well, the director is going to be quite busy for the next few weeks, so she wanted to get something out of the way first. If you'll follow me..."
Vincent led Jason into the administration building. The director is hoping that you can resume the pace of handling contracts you demonstrated when you first joined the society, Vincent said as they walked. Most of our best adventurers just left.
No worries, Jason said. Most of the people I know just left town, so I figured I'd throw myself into it. I was expecting there to be more trouble over killing those adventurers.
The recording makes it quite plain what they were there for, Vincent said. What really clinched it was that most of them hadn't taken a contract in months. Some hadn't taken one at all. The director hates that kind of adventurer with a passion, something to do with her upbringing, I'd been told. She was more than happy to just push it under the rug.
I've heard she isn't from one of the big families, Jason said, that she made her way up out of Old City.
That's about as much as anyone has heard. She doesn't talk about her past, at least to me.
She respects privacy, unlike someone I know. I'm having a barbie tonight, if you'd care to join.
A barbie?
A barbecue, mate. Nice and casual. A few mates still in town, they're all bringing people. You can bring some Adventure Society people if you'd like. Clive's bringing some Magic Society people, plus their families. We've got enough meat to sink a ship, and Norwich Distillery is putting on the drinks. Fair warning, though, leave your social stratification at the door. Duke or Dunny Cleaner, everyone's a mate at an Asano barbie.
I'll think about it, Vincent said.
Norwich Distillery, you say?
Yep, Jason said. Norwich will be there himself, along with some of his workers. They're bringing a few barrels along.
Vincent led them into what turned out to be a magical elevator. Jason knew they were in some of the island's taller buildings, but it was his first time using one. The ride was swift and smooth, depositing them on the top floor. Vincent led Jason to a door with a plaque proclaiming it to be the office of the branch director. Vincent led them in without knocking. Jason and Vincent went in to find the director, Elspeth Arella, sitting behind a paperwork-covered desk. At another desk was the elderly elf who had assessed Jason for his promotion. They were both busily writing, and Vincent gestured for patience. Looking around, Jason noticed several paintings of desert landscapes hung on the walls. They were all by the same artist, who painted a similar work Jason favored at the concert hall.
I like your taste in art, he said to the director. You have a lot of Moa's work.
He's a friend of the family, the director said absently. I'll be with you in a moment, Asano.
Vincent gave Jason an admonishing frown, and they waited until the director and deputy director finished their work. Once the papers had been signed and filed, they turned to Vincent and Jason.
G'day, Jason said, offering his hand over the desk to the elderly elf.
We haven't been properly introduced.
Genevieve Picot, she said, curtly shaking his hand. Deputy director.
We're quite busy, Mr. Asano, Arella said. So I'll be brief. First, thank you for not making a fuss about being excluded from the expedition. I know you have enough connections now that you could have.
Plenty of people did,
Genevieve said unhappily.
Second, Arella said, I was very impressed at your handling of the lumber mill contract. You could have been loud about it, but you weren't. The thoroughness with which you investigated and collected evidence gave me some much-appreciated political capital.
I didn't do it that way to give you another stick to whack the Duke with, Jason said. I did it because that's where the contract took me.
Yet your response demonstrated an awareness of the political realities, Arella said. She opened a drawer on her desk and took out a small bamboo box, handing it over to him. He slid off the top to see a round crystal inside and tapped a finger to it.
Item: Awakening Stone of Judgment. Unranked. Rare. An awakening stone containing the power of adjudication. Consumable. Awakening stone. Requirements. Unawakened essence ability. Effect. Awakens an essence ability. You have 3 unawakened essence abilities. You are able to absorb Awakening Stone of Judgment. Absorb? Yes, no.
Judgment? Jason mused. It seemed appropriate, given that's what you've demonstrated, Arella said. We're rather understaffed right now, so if anything unexpected arises, we'll need people to take on leadership roles. At Iron Rank, you will be one of those people.
Hand over your badge, please. Jason frowned as he took out his badge and handed it over.
You're promoting me? Jason asked. Days after I killed a fistful of adventurers?
They weren't adventurers, Arella said darkly. They were the filth clinging to the side of a boat, in desperate need of righting.
She took out a wedge-shaped stone and tapped it to Jason's iron badge. The metal shifted as the two stars embossed on it were joined by a third, and she handed it back.
No big, imposing room? Jason asked. No officious questioning?
The rules only require three officials present, including at least one of director or deputy director level. We have a lot to do, Mr. Asano, and such proceedings aren't as valuable with some members as they are with others.
Fair enough, Jason said.
You know, if you need to wind down after work, I am having a barbie tonight.
The turnout for Jason's barbecue was larger than he expected. They had staked out a section of the park district, bringing out picnic tables with colourful tablecloths. Norwich Norwich had set up a long bar. There was a whole army of grillers covered in sizzling meat, fish wrapped in bamboo leaves, vegetables and fruit.
Good thing I overdid it on food, Jason said.
Thanks for wrangling the extra grills, Jessica.
It was my absolute pleasure, Madame Landry said.
Other people in the park district had wandered over and were invited to join in. There was some kind of three-way ball game happening, the participants having marked out a triangular field. The teams were Magic Society versus Adventure Society versus the people that were both. The mixed team had Clive as captain. Jason spotted a pair of elves looking on at a remove, standing under a tree. Jason teleported through the tree's shadow to join them.
You made it after all, he said to them.
You've created quite a commotion in the park district, Arella said. You did get permission for this, right?
As you know, he said, Thalia Mercer owed me for not throwing her crappy son under the bus. Her brother-in-law is the Duke, so it wasn't hard to get.
This is how you spend your political capital? Genevieve asked.
What's the point of money and power if you don't enjoy it? I don't suppose either of you ladies can explain the rules of that ball game?
You don't know tribal, Arella asked.
You really are from another world.
Chapter 99 Someone Else's Game. Dean Tuckle was part of a team of adventurers that had arrived in a village in the Delta. The team was a makeshift one, put together for a road contract, patrolling a fixed route through the Delta and beyond under the supervision of a bronze ranker. The others were unhappy to be on punishment duty instead of the big expedition, while Dean was just happy to get away from the city. He didn't want the people still working for Thadwick Mercer to find him and take him out for a little chat. The team moved straight to the adventure notice board.
This one actually has a notice, the bronze rank team leader said, taking it from the board. This was their third village for the day, and every notice board had been empty.
Trap weavers. The bronze ranker read, causing the iron rankers to groan.
Wait, this one's been claimed already, the bronze ranker said. Just not completed yet.
As he said it, the paper dissolved away to nothing in his hand.
And now it has, he said. Next village on the list, then.
Can't we stop for a drink? Someone asked. There's a tavern right there.
We can stop once we've dealt with at least one monster, the bronze ranker said. Assuming we can find one.
Jason dropped a stack of papers on the registration desk in the jobs hall. 3 contracts, 11 board notices, he said.
In 3 days, Albert said. That's some schedule you've got going.
Any assigned contracts for me?
No, but there are a few incentivized contracts. Fewer adventurers means less competition.
I think I'll leave those for others, Jason said. Maybe it'll get a few more people picking up contracts. Jason didn't need to go back to his inn for a shower, having cleaned himself off with a bottle of crystal wash. Switching from his battle robes to casual civilian attire, he caught the loop line out of the Adventure Society campus to the park district and bought a flatbread wrap from a food cart. He ate it on a park bench with a fruit drink from his inventory while he watched the sun go down. Not bad, he said to himself. He took the World Phoenix tablet from his inventory and looked at it in his hand. Since being told it was his way home, he'd considered throwing it away time and again, closing that door forever. As always, he put it back in his inventory. When the sun dropped below the horizon, a city worker came along the pathways of the park district, lighting up the magic lamps. Jason got up, walked away from the paths, and into the darkness. He withdrew his sword and a crystal, similar to a recording crystal. He tossed it away from himself, where it stopped and floated in the air. A few moments later, a soft, entrancing sound started coming from it. Jason drew his sword from its scabbard, which he dropped onto the grass as his cloak of stars appeared around him. He started moving in time with the meditative music. His movements were slow and small, deliberate and smooth, something between a sword cutter and a dance. Gradually, his motion became larger, with moments of speed, although always completely controlled. His cloak flowed around him, throwing off motes of light. The dance of the sword fairy was a meditation technique Rufus had taught him that merged mind and body. Despite the inclusion of the sword, it wasn't about fighting. The goal was to meld the conscious and unconscious. Rufus had described the goal not as using the sword, but becoming it. Ability, verdict, doom has reached iron, 0, 100%. Ability, verdict, doom has advanced to iron, 1, 0, 0%. Jason ignored his newest ability advancing, losing himself to the dance as movement and meditation became one. He felt as if he were merging with the world around him. Something tickled at his senses, so faint he wasn't sure it was there at all. He continued on, but sensed it again. And this time he was sure. He stopped, looking off into the darkness.
"You sensed me," a male voice said. "That's quite the surprise."
The accent reminded Jason of Rufus. He couldn't see anything in the dark, even with his vision power, and he could no longer sense what was out there.
"Meditation increases sensitivity," Jason said to the hidden person.
"An impressive feat, even so," the man said. "You must have been deep in it. My apologies for disturbing you."
A man walked out of the darkness, which Jason found disorienting. He could see through the darkness, yet the man was invisible to him until he didn't want to be. He had midnight black skin like Rufus, but instead of being bald, his hair was dark, woven into rows and threaded with colorful beads. His outfit was neat and fitted, also like Rufus preferred.
"Not at all, Mr. Bahadir," Jason said. "I've been looking forward to meeting you."
The man raised an eyebrow.
"How did you know?"
"Your aura," Jason said. "I've been around enough silver rankers to know what it feels like when they restrain their aura. There's a stillness, almost an absence of power, like the shadow of an unseen object. Your aura melds into the surroundings like there's nothing there at all. There's only one gold ranker expected to come here, and the accent and the clothes just clinch it."
Bahadir laughed, moving closer to shake Jason's hand. From that simple contact, Jason could feel the power flowing through him. Bahadir's hand was perfectly controlled, lest his gold rank strength crush Jason's hand with more ease than crushing an egg.
"Emir Bahadir," he introduced himself.
"Jason Asano.
I've been hearing a lot about you, and wanted to see for myself."
"I've been hearing about you too," Jason said. "How was the wine festival?"
Bahadir laughed again.
"Very fine, thank you. How have Rufus and his friends been?"
"Also very fine. They're not in town right now."
"So I've heard." "There's no rush. I'm not officially arriving for a little over a week."
"Well, if you're looking for something to catch your interest, I suggest a visit to the Magic Society. They're excavating a complex out in the Delta that belonged to the Order of the Reaper. That is why you're here, right? To investigate the ancient Order of Assassins?"
"I didn't think Rufus had such loose lips."
Oh, he didn't tell me, Jason said. Neither he nor the Magic Society knows about the connection.
But you do.
Some friends and I found the place, but the Magic Society cut us out. You'd be amazed at what a rogue Magic Society official and an acolyte of knowledge can dig up between them. Someone tried very hard to erase these assassins from history.
So, if you haven't told Rufus, and you haven't told the Magic Society, why tell me?
You wanted to see me for yourself, Jason said. Call this me wanting to make a good first impression. At the very least, I'm capable of piquing your interest until Rufus gets back. Let's just hope he doesn't take 3 months. Jason stood in the ruins of a coastal village. It had been one of many such villages scattered along the desert coast. They made an industry out of scouring the waters for water quintessence, which formed in larger than normal proportions due to the magic of the Mistrun River washing out to sea. Villagers up and down the coast made a living from that, and fishing, but it was not a practice without risk.
Sundown, right? Jason asked.
That's the normal pattern, Vincent said.
Are you sure you want to do this?
They glanced around at the broken remains of the village. It was very small, mostly constructed from bamboo, and it looked like a hurricane had passed through. Boats and buildings ranged from severely damaged to smashed into pieces. There were net drying racks and other paraphernalia of a coastal village, none of which was left untouched. Scraps of netting, broken barrels, and the remnants of objects too destroyed to recognize made up a carpet of debris. The only two-story building was stone on the bottom floor and bamboo on top. There was a dinghy jutting out of a wall of the upper level. The doorway on the ground floor had been ripped wider, brickwork cast aside in huge chunks. Inside was some kind of nest made out of debris and the bones of large sea animals. Jason spotted the skeletons of fish upward of a meter and a half long.
That's where it's been coming back to, Vincent said. That's the normal pattern. Roam the waters, attacking deep-sea fish, and coming on shore to raid villages. It picks the first territory it conquers to make a lair.
But it's slower out of the water, right?
Very, Vincent said. But you can see for yourself how strong it is. If it's hurt badly, it will retreat into the ocean. Submerged, it will move faster and heal very quickly. Do not pursue it into the water.
Other than that, though, no exotic abilities?
No.
Jason knew all of this, but wanted the assurance of double-checking. The tidal troll was the first bronze rank monster Jason would face on purpose, and he was facing it alone. He brought up his character sheet to help his resolve.
Jason Asano. Race, Outworlder. Current rank, Iron. Progression to bronze rank, 10%. 2 of 4 essences, complete. Attributes, Power, Blood, Iron 2. Speed, Dark, Iron 0. Spirit, Doom, Iron 0. Recovery, Sin, Iron 2. Racial abilities, Outworlder. Party interface, quest system, inventory, map, astral affinity, mysterious stranger. Essences, 4 of 4. Dark, Speed, 3 of 5. Midnight Eyes, Special Ability, Iron, 7, 84%. Cloak of Night, Special Ability, Iron, 6, 19%. Path of Shadows, Special Ability, Iron, 6, 21%. Blood, Power, 5 of 5. Blood Harvest, Spell, Iron, 5, 18%. Leech Bite, Special Attack, Iron, 5, 78%. Feast of Blood, Spell, Iron, 4, 97%. Sanguine Horror, Familiar, Iron, 5, 16%. Hemorrhage, Spell, Iron, 2, 46%. Sin, Recovery, 5 of 5. Punish, Special Attack, Iron, 5, 83%. Feast of Absolution, Spell, Iron, 5, 91%. Sin Eater, Special Ability, Iron, 5, 69%. Hegemony, Aura, Iron 5, 67%. Castigate, Spell, Iron 2, 32%. Doom, Spirit, 4 of 5. Inexorable Doom, Spell, Iron 5, 66%. Punition, Spell, Iron 3, 57%. Blade of Doom, Spell, Iron 2, 08%. Verdict, Spell, Iron 1, 00%. His abilities were coming along, with only three more to awaken before he was truly on the way to bronze.
If anything goes wrong, I'm stepping in, Vincent said.
That's why you came along? Jason asked. You think I'll fail?
Actually, I had a favor to ask.
Oh?
They were looking out at the ocean, sun lighting the sky with gold as it dropped to the horizon.
It'll return to its lair soon, but we should have time to talk, Vincent said.
You're aware of the open contract, the thief girl.
I'm aware.
Have you considered going after it? The society has added an awakening stone to the rewards.
It smells political, Jason said. I don't have any interest in jumping on the board just to end up a piece in someone else's game.
Vincent smiled wanly.
I know exactly what you mean, he said. I support the changes the director is trying to make, but she's pushing back against a long-entrenched network of power. No one is playing fair, and it's the mid-level officials like me being squeezed between powerful forces.
This thief's activities are becoming a point of contention between the director and the traditional power brokers?
It could have been anything, I think. This just happened to turn up, and she's using it.
And now you have pressure from both sides.
Exactly. I don't want to go against the director, but she either doesn't know or is willing to accept the collateral damage. I'm not sure she understands how much that is hurting her. A lot of people have been happy to move away from the corruption of the past, but the director is pressuring the aristocrats who are pulling hard on all the old levers. People who should be the director's allies are becoming very unhappy.
So you want me to take this point of contention out of play? Jason said. Give people some room to breathe while the big knobs find the next vicarious battle.
Yes. The director has been relying on the fact that there aren't a lot of iron rankers with the skill set to chase her down. You're fast and good in darkness, and the thief mostly strikes at night. Have you noticed that any time you aren't busy with a contract, one gets assigned to you?
Sounds familiar.
I've been looking at any adventurers with the right skills to chase the thief, and they've been getting the same treatment. For most of them, the assigned contracts have been lucrative enough to not turn down. She knows that isn't your driving factor, so she's been assigning contracts she thinks you'll find interesting. Underground tunnels, spirit coin farms, recovering a dead adventurer's remains. Jason considered as they watched the sun drop below the horizon.
You know you're asking me to do something she won't like, he said.
That's why I came to you. Out of the various adventurers she's been keeping busy, you're the only one that would do it anyway.
That, and I bet she shuffled the rest off on the expedition.
Most, but not all. We do need some competent people left to actually do the work.
All right, Jason said. The best I can do is look into it. I'm making no promises. There's every chance she runs rings around me the same as everyone else that went after her.
That's all I can ask, Vincent said. Rufus believes in your resourcefulness, as does the director. Otherwise, she wouldn't be keeping you busy. It was near dark when a huge form rose up from the water. Vincent withdrew as it moved closer to shore, more and more of the huge body rising above the surface until it strode onto the beach. It moved into the village, where Jason got a better look at it than he wanted. Once he realized the monster was buck naked. It was around 5 meters tall, and over one shoulder carried a dead shark that could have swallowed Jason whole. The troll's skin was the blue-gray of the ocean on an overcast day, and rough like that of the shark it was carrying. Dangling in a tangled mess from the troll's head was what looked more like kelp than hair. Light erupted from Jason's cloak, scattering motes of illumination through the village. Shadows were everywhere in the shattered remains of the beach hamlet, from the broken boats to half-collapsed buildings. The tidal troll roared at Jason and lumbered forward, swinging the shark like a flail. Jason started with his old snake-tooth dagger, which ignored bronze-rank poison resistances and damage reduction. Appearing behind the monster, Jason scored the back of its leg. Weapon, Nightfang, has inflicted umbral snake venom on tidal troll. By the time the sluggish giant turned around, Jason was gone. Soon after, the monster was sprayed with leeches from another direction,
and they had plenty of flesh to latch onto. From the shadows, Jason winced as they bit into parts of the troll. Jason would have preferred remain covered. The monster was tough, perhaps even tougher than the Hydra, and with resistances to match. The sheer quantity of leeches meant afflictions were landing, however, and Jason went to work on bringing those resistances down. Switching to his conjured dagger, he ran shadowy rings around the troll as he landed strike after strike. Weapon, Ruin, has inflicted Vulnerable on Tidal Troll. Between his elusive strikes and casting spells from the shadows, all of Jason's afflictions eventually took hold, while the troll alternated flailing ineffectually at Jason and brushing away leeches with its huge hand. It stomped on those pushed onto the ground, but even its enormous feet could only catch so many. All the while, every instance of the Sin Curse allowed Jason's aura to further decrease the troll's resistances, as did the vulnerable affliction from his new dagger. Vulnerable, affliction, unholy, stacking. All resistances are reduced. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Consume to cleanse instances of resistant on a one-to-one basis. With inexorable doom racking up more instances of both, the troll eventually stopped resisting the effects at all. With leeches in full effect, the creature was ravaged and fled for the ocean. Vincent ran up to Jason.
"It's making for the water," Vincent said urgently. "If it makes it in, it'll start healing."
"No, it wouldn't," Jason said. "But it won't get that far anyway." He didn't move from where he stood. Unhurried, he raised an arm in the monster's direction and chanted a spell.
"Suffer the cost of your transgressions."
The creature's resistances were in ruins, but its bronze rank damage reduction was still in effect. Even so, the punition spell inflicted damage for each of the myriad afflictions on the troll. It was enough that most monsters, even at bronze rank, would be dead already. The troll stumbled as its flesh withered and turned black, but continued staggering forward. Jason chanted a final spell.
"Mine is the judgment, and the judgment is death."
Light of silver, gold, and blue shone down on the troll from above, and under its radiance, the monster's body started rapidly dissolving into rainbow smoke. Leeches dropped out of the air as the flesh they were burying themselves in vanished. In the spot where it had been fighting, gobbets of blood and flesh remained, patches of light shining to eradicate them as well. In moments, there was nothing left of the troll but a memory. Ability, verdict, doom, spell, execute, cost, moderate mana, cooldown, 30 seconds, current rank, iron, 1.01%. Effect, iron, deals a small amount of transcendent damage. As an execute effect, damage scales exponentially with the enemy's level of injury.
"Was that transcendent damage?"
Vincent asked incredulously. "Yes," Jason said, as he glanced over the rewards. "You have defeated Tidal Troll. Tidal Troll has been wholly annihilated. It has been looted automatically. Gauntlet of the Sea Giant has been added to your inventory. Monster Core, Bronze, has been added to your inventory. 10 Bronze Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. 100 Iron Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. Quest, Contract, Tidal Troll. Objective complete. Eliminate Tidal Troll, 1 of 1. Necklace of the Deep has been added to your inventory. Quest complete. 100 Bronze Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory. 1,000 Iron Spirit Coins have been added to your inventory."
"What ability was that?"
Vincent asked, as he stared at the spot where the monster had been annihilated.
"That's a rude question,"
Jason said absently, also staring at the space where the troll vanished.
"You're dealing transcendent damage with an iron rank ability. Do you know what transcendent damage does?"
"I do."
"Help, transcendent damage. Transcendent damage ignores all forms of physical and magical defense, damage reduction, and resistances."
"So, what ability is that?" Jason turned to look at Vincent, his face unreadable.
"It's the end,"
Jason told him, his voice flat and emotionless.
"The end? The end of what?" "Of whatever I want."
Jason's hard expression suddenly broke into a grin, and he laughed.
Listen to me, right?
Whatever I want, I'm very scary.
I need to stop listening to that toony angel on my shoulder. Colin, gather up.
This sea air isn't good for you.
Chapter 100. Legwork. Danielle Geller and Thalia Mercer looked at the water pouring out of the astral space aperture. It was within a crevice in a rocky outcropping, but was itself a free-floating circle of shimmering blue. The water streamed out of the aperture, the source of a small creek they were currently standing in. It wasn't the overwhelming torrent that some apertures had, which is why they had chosen this particular one. There wasn't so much force that people couldn't push their way against the water to enter. The other reason being that the first two apertures they tried had already failed and vanished.
You've been in the astral space before, haven't you? Danielle asked.
Last monster surge, Thalia said. Monsters were spawning out of an aperture in the desert, so we set up a defense point just inside.
The advantage of having your family seat in a city, Danielle said. I spent the whole time defending the estate.
Danielle turned back to look at the expedition arrayed out behind her. The order of entry had already been organized, with the Silver Rankers heading through first to scout and deal with any immediate trouble. She turned back, took a deep breath, and pushed herself through the water streaming out. She emerged underwater, disoriented, spreading out her senses to get a grasp on her surroundings. Finding a sandy bottom, she kicked off of it to push herself up, breaching the surface as the water was not very deep. As she swam away from the submerged aperture in the water, Danielle took a look at her surroundings. She was in a turquoise lagoon under a clear cerulean sky. The lagoon was mostly bounded by rocky rises, with scrubby trees growing up the sides, but she spotted a small, sandy beach. Behind it were trees and tropical plants. Thalia emerged from the aperture and likewise quickly surfaced.
Nice, Thalia said, swimming away from the aperture to give the next person space. It'll be good to explore instead of just staying near the aperture and fighting monsters.
Clive entered the office of the Magic Society director. As normal, the director was absent, while the deputy director, Poshard Finn, was at work behind his own desk. Poshard barely glanced up at the intrusion, continuing to write as he spoke.
What is it, Standish? I don't have a lot of time with all these people off on the expedition.
I'm aware, sir, Clive said. I've been very busy myself, but I've managed to get things reorganized, so I'd like to take some time on another project. As you know, I have an Adventure Society membership.
Yes, I heard about the Marsh Hydra, Poshard said. I can't imagine your contribution was all that much, but well done.
There's an open contract with the Adventure Society, Clive said. A friend and I want to take a crack at it.
Poshard paused his writing to look up at Clive.
You want to slack off so you can go to social events in the hope this thief shows up?
Actually, sir, we're going to take a different approach, something that will hopefully have more success.
Who is this friend of yours?
He's another Iron Ranker, Jason Asano.
The one who handled the lumber mill affair,
Poshard mused thoughtfully.
You know him?
I like to keep apprised of goings-on, Poshard said. You're sure your duties will be covered?
I won't be completely absent, sir. I'll be checking in each day to make sure everything is running smoothly.
Then take what time you need, so long as you still feel your chances of success are reasonable.
Really?
Clive asked. Poshard turned back to his work.
Learn to take yes for an answer, Standish.
Clive called on Jason in his lodgings. Jason had papers scattered over the refreshment table, picking some up to read from the comfort of a lounge chair.
How did it go?
Jason asked.
Surprisingly well,
Clive said, still registering the surprise. He nodded at all the papers.
What's all that?
A copy of the contract of service between the Adventure Society and the City of Greenstone. If the Duke of Greenstone and the Adventure Society director are playing some kind of game with this thief as the central piece, I thought I should get a look at the board.
And?
Clive asked, sitting down. It's possible this whole thing is about trying to get the Duke to violate the terms of the agreement. It gives local authorities a lot of influence in Adventure Society affairs. It would make sense, given that Elspeth Arella's driving goal is to eliminate that influence. I'm inclined to think it isn't, though.
Why not?
This agreement is up for renegotiation in a couple of years, and the director doesn't strike me as an impatient person. If she were to violate the terms herself, trying to provoke the Duke, he could appeal to the core branches of the Adventure Society, maybe even get Arella replaced. Given her proclivities are a direct threat to aristocratic power, having almost anyone else in her seat when the negotiations come up is a win for him. I don't think she's willing to take that risk when all she has to do is wait for her chance to renegotiate terms.
Then what is it all about?
I'm not sure, Jason said. There's some third factor beyond the Duke and Arella's basic agendas. Arella wants something, and she's willing to push the boundaries to get it.
How does that affect us? We're just trying to catch the thief.
It's the knife you don't see that stabs you, Clive.
What next, then?
We turn off the filter, pinch one off in the pool, and see who comes to clean it up.
What?
We catch the thief and see who tries to stop us.
What if they do stop us?
Have some self-confidence, man. Jason started gathering the scattered pages. There were a few interesting things in the agreement, Jason said, as he put them away in a leather folder. The Adventure Society has quite a lot of say in civic affairs when it involves a society contract. Interestingly, it puts that power with the individual adventurers executing the contracts rather than the society itself.
What does that matter?
The loosened adventurer standards have allowed more or less the entire aristocracy to be nominal members of the Adventure Society, so decentralizing power is another means for the aristocracy to circumvent the authority of the Adventure Society's higher officials. I'm starting to understand what Arella is up against now. It's something worth knowing, another trick to have up the sleeve.
What now, then?
Clive asked.
I know we won't be randomly attending social events hoping they get robbed. People have been trying that for months, and it hasn't worked.
Then what do you think should be the first step?
Figure out what they're doing and how, right?
I was thinking the same thing, Jason said. We need to go talk to all the victims, learn as much about what was taken and the thief's methodology as we can.
Are these people going to talk to us?
Jason chuckled. These are people used to having power, not being the victim, and there isn't anything they can do about it. Don't underestimate how much that will eat at them. They know that the Adventure Society isn't letting anyone other than Iron Rankers in on this, so a 3-star is the best they can hope for. Add in an assist from a Magic Society official, and it will seem like a ray of hope. They'll cooperate.
And if they don't?
We'll talk them into it.
You say that like it's going to be easy.
Jason and Clive left the townhouse of Lord Vordis and started heading towards the closest Loop Line transit station. Lord Vordis was a minor noble, but one known for making useful connections between the upper and lower echelons of society.
Are you sure you should have done that?
Clive asked, glancing back nervously. Done what? Jason asked innocently.
Told him the Mercers sent you.
I didn't do that.
I was there. But were you really listening?
I never said the Mercers sent me. Yes, the conversation happened to go in such a way that certain connections between myself and the Mercer family came to light. And I suppose I can see how that particular topic of conversation, in proximity to other topics, may have led some people to assume that the Mercers sent me, but I made no such assertion. I'm not responsible for other people's assumptions, Clive.
It really seems like you are.
We got what we were after, and that's the important thing.
I can't believe he told you he was smuggling sump coil rods, Clive said. They're restricted by the Adventure Society and the Magic Society, but he told an adventurer and a Magic Society official.
Lucky this town's so corrupt, Jason said. He figured there wouldn't be any major repercussions.
Because he thought the Mercer family sent you.
I told you that I'm not responsible for the assumptions of others. What are sump coil rods, anyway?
They're used to create very small areas that are invisible to magical senses, Clive said,
auras, tracking abilities, seeking rituals. Nothing short of gold rank ritual or ability stands a chance. Very small spaces, though, about the size of a laundry basket.
What are they used for?
The big thing about them is they don't trip warnings. A lot of detection magic, be that abilities, rituals, or items, give back a negative reading if they hit a zone they can't penetrate. Use sump coil rods the right way, and most things won't even register the negative space.
You think maybe they took them to create a hideout they can't be traced to? Jason asked. You use a bunch of those rods to stack the spaces?
That wouldn't be practical, and they didn't take enough of the rods.
Well, we just keep collecting puzzle pieces, Jason said. Eventually, we'll have enough to figure out the picture.
Jason and Clive were in Jason's lodgings, poring over notes. Jason's were scattered over the refreshments table in the lounge area, while Clive laid claim to the dining table. More than a week into their investigation, Jason's lodgings were so deep in notes, maps, lists, and magical tool design documents that Madame Landry refused to have her staff clean around it.
"You just tell me when you're done, and I'll send people in," she had told Jason. "Just don't leave it too long, or I'll send people in anyway."
In almost 3 months, the thief had done 17 jobs. Every day Jason and Clive would go from victim to victim, scene to scene, gathering information.
"They're basically doing two kinds of jobs," Jason mused. "The first type is public, usually some kind of snatch and grab of valuables. These jobs are in open places with plenty of escape routes. The loot is, frankly, not worth the risk. It tends to be highly specific, which would make fencing it tricky."
"A lot of adventurers have been taking that angle," Clive said. "The Magic Society has sold a lot of appraisal tools in the last few months."
"The other type of job tends to be specialized magic equipment. Rare, valuable, sometimes restricted. They've taken much bigger risks for these jobs as well. Every time they've come close to being caught, it was on this type of job."
"Whoever this thief is," Clive said, "they either have an interesting understanding of magical tools or are working with someone who does. Aura masking, material deconstruction, bypassing magical protections. Her methods speak to an eclectic magical knowledge, most likely specialized for this kind of work."
"A professional thief," Jason said. "That's hardly a surprise at this point."
"I'd love to meet them. Their unorthodox approach to magical study would be fascinating to discuss."
"The whole point of this is so you can do exactly that," Jason said, sorting through the piles of paper in front of him. He frowned, looking at them all. "There's a lot of paper in this city for a place with such a small lumber industry."
"This is all reed paper. There's a local reed that grows prolifically in the Delta," Clive explained absently, not looking up from his own notes. "It's a fairly easy process to produce paper from it. Pulp it, a little bit of magic, and here you go. It's one of the local exports."
"Reed paper," Jason said, running a sheet between his fingers. "I wouldn't have guessed that. This is high-quality stuff." Clive started reorganizing all the papers in front of him. Some he placed into neat order on the table, others he stacked in haphazard piles on the chairs around it.
"The snatch and grabs are obviously some kind of distraction from their true intention," he reasoned.
"Agreed," Jason said. "Clearly their true intention is all these magical supplies they're taking on the other jobs.
If I can figure out what all of it is for, then maybe we can figure out their ultimate objective."
He stood up, rubbing his temples.
"I need a break to clear my head."
Jason glanced at the clock on the wall. Like everything in Madame Landry's inn, it was tasteful, understated in design, and worked perfectly.
"It's almost time we headed out anyway," Jason said. "There's something that should be worth seeing."
"Is it something to do with the mysterious group taking over the expedition to explore that complex we found?" Clive asked. "Word came down from on high to let them take over, which didn't impress Lucian Lamprey."
"Who?" Jason asked.
"Oh, the director of the Magic Society. Haven't had the pleasure yet."
"Pleasure isn't the word I'd use. Still, it was gratifying to see it taken off him the way it was taken off me."
"Well, you can meet the man who took it off him," Jason said. "He's scheduled to arrive this afternoon." Chapter 101. Fantasy World Goodness. Jason and Clive made their way to the northern side of the Adventure Society campus, which occupied much of the western side of the island's north shore. They passed a grey stone tower that Jason now recognized as the prison tower. The society was only allowed to hold prisoners taken as part of a contract, while others went to the courthouse jail. It had briefly held the man who attacked him at the lumber mill, Jerick, before he was stripped of his society membership and sent packing. Getting closer to the North Shore, they skirted around the memorial grounds where they had attended a solemn service 3 weeks earlier. They both gave sober glances to the mausoleum as they went past. The memorial grounds occupied a good chunk of the shoreline, while the private dock took up most of the rest.
"Isn't this a bad place for a dock?" Jason asked. "It'd be very exposed to the elements."
"It's rarely used," Clive said. "Usually by prestigious visiting adventurers who get dropped off before the ship moves on to the ports. Sometimes vessels with important cargo for the Adventure Society or Magic Society."
The Adventure Society's private dock had a few buildings nestled into garden grounds where the plant life was chosen for its resilience to salty sea winds. Clive pointed them out, explaining their purpose to Jason. The largest was a service building, right up against the dock. The smallest was a processing building for ship's crews. The middle-sized building was nicer than the others, an arrival and departure lounge with space for lavish functions. As they went inside, there was no elaborate function set out, but the small crowd looked like all the prestige Greenstone could muster, at least while so many luminaries were absent on the expedition. As Clive's gaze wandered over the assemblage, he became increasingly startled. He recognized the directors and deputy directors of both the Magic Society and the Adventure Society. There was the Duke of Greenstone and his brother, Beaufort Mercer.
"It's Cassandra's dad," Jason said.
"You've met him then?"
"There was a brief, stilted encounter. Reserved respect isn't really my strongest play."
"You might want to consider what that says about you," Clive said.
Along with the nobility, there were representatives of the various temples. That including Gabrielle Pellin, who had been helping Clive with his investigation into the underground complex. She was standing with one of her church's more high-ranking members. Given how many of the city's elite were off on the expedition, it was an absurdly high-class gathering. Jason led Clive away from the group gathered near the doors. The lounge was spacious with glass, dockside frontage, so they easily found some isolated seats that still afforded them a view of the ocean.
"Jason, what is this?" Clive whispered as they sat down. "That's my boss, and my boss's boss. The Duke, a bunch of silver rankers."
A few curious glances were thrown their way. Jason sensed as much as saw the look Elspeth Arella gave him, with the weight of her silver rank aura behind it. It wasn't a suppressive force, but made itself unmistakably felt.
"Let's just keep our distance," Jason said. "I'm not sure I can be around that much wealth inequality without going on a socialist rant."
Jason looked out over the water.
"I always meant to ask what the tides are like with two moons," Jason said.
"What?"
Clive asked, still distracted by the crowd. He turned to Jason with a confused frown.
"What do tides have to do with the moons?"
"The moon has a huge effect on tides," Jason said. "I can only imagine it's bigger with two. What is it you think causes tidal action?"
"It's not really my field," Clive said, "but the prevailing theory is that it is a function of ambient magic. We just can't test it because we would have to monitor the whole planet's magical field for an extended period, or a good size chunk of the planet at least."
"No, that's all wrong, mate. What you're dealing with is...
Gabrielle?" "I'm dealing with Gabrielle,"
Clive asked, then noticed Jason looking past him. Gabrielle had left the group and was approaching them as swiftly as her formal robes would allow.
"Jason!"
she insistently hissed, wanting to be forceful without being loud.
"You can't tell people that."
"I can't tell people what?"
"About that thing you were about to tell him about. Hello, by the way, Clive."
"Acolyte Pellin,"
Clive greeted her.
"I can't tell people about gravity?"
"No, you can't. Some things people have to figure out for themselves."
"This is your boss telling you this, then?" Jason said.
"Yes,"
Gabrielle said. She said you can't just go around telling people about fundamental aspects of physical reality, especially not someone like Clive.
Fundamental aspects of physical reality? Clive asked.
Wait, why not someone like me?
Gabrielle gave Clive a friendlier look than the forceful one she had been giving Jason.
Because you'll run around telling everyone, Gabrielle told him. My lady quite likes you, by the way.
Really? Clive asked. She knows who I am.
She knows who everyone is, Clive, Jason said. She knows everything except what a private conversation is, apparently.
Jason, Gabrielle said. She says the people of this world have to learn important things for themselves, instead of from some dimension-hopping loon.
Did she tell you to say that? Jason asked.
She was very explicit. She said that if you keep your mouth shut for once, she'll give you a gift.
Bribery, Jason said, thinking it over.
Yeah, all right.
Gabrielle nodded and turned back for the group, some of whom had been looking on with curiosity. Many of them had the perception of a silver-ranked spirit attribute and could have easily eavesdropped.
Gravity?
Clive asked. Did you not just hear me get bribed not to tell you? She'd know immediately. A look of contemplation crossed Jason's face.
She knows when you've been naughty, he mused.
She brings gifts, apparently. Halfway back to the group, Gabrielle wheeled around and stormed back to Jason, waving a finger in his face.
I don't know what a flirty Santa Claus is, she scolded, but my goddess definitely isn't one.
Does she have a big temple to the north where elves make toys?
What?
Clive and Gabrielle asked.
Look, Jason said, pointing out to sea.
I think it's kicking off. Their eyes followed where Jason's hand was pointing until they spotted what looked like a massive cloud on the horizon.
What is that? Clive asked.
It's magical, but I can't make anything out at this distance.
You don't know?
Gabrielle asked.
Why are you here?
Jason wouldn't tell me.
I thought it would be a fun surprise, Jason said defensively.
What are you up to?
Clive asked Jason warily.
Actually, it should be kind of a fun surprise, Gabrielle conceded.
They watched as the massive cloud moved closer.
It's a ship,
Clive said.